Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch. I'm joined by P.W. Singer, one of the authors of the book Burn-In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. His co-author is August Cole. P.W. Singer is strategist at New America and a professor of practice at Arizona State University. Described in the Wall Street Journal as the premier futurist in the national security environment, he's been named by the Smithsonian as one of the nation's 100 leading innovators, by Defense News as one of the 100 most influential people in defense issues, by Foreign Policy to their top 100 global thinkers list, and as an official mad scientist for the U.S. Army's Training and Doctrine Command. He was most recently a guest here on New Books in National Security to discuss his book Like War, which explored how social media has changed war and politics, and it was named an Amazon and Foreign Affairs Book of the Year. PW, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks so much.
I mentioned you last visited the podcast for your book, Like War, and it's great to talk to you again. Can you catch us up on what you've been working on and how you came to write this new book, Burn-In?
Sure. So Burn-In is both a new book, but also a new kind of book. It is a smash-up of nonfiction research with narrative. So let me unpack that. Burn-In is a techno thriller. So it's a story that follows an FBI agent on the hunt for a new kind of terrorist through the streets of a future Washington, D.C. Future, so that means it's obviously not happened yet. However, baked into the story are over 300 explanations and predictions, everything from how does AI actually work? What are the planned applications for AI, face recognition, Internet of Things, and locations that range from how will the military use it to how will the police use it to Starbucks to what is Amazon's plan for delivery drones? But even more among those is then what are the expected effects and dilemmas that these new technologies and uses will create. And they might be political dilemmas, economic dilemmas, social dilemmas, security, national security, all the way down to individual cybersecurity dilemmas. And going back to the nonfiction aspect of it, it's not just that it has these insights baked into the story, just like you would in a nonfiction book. It has end notes for them, actually 27 pages of end notes overall. So just like in nonfiction, whenever a certain technology is mentioned, a certain issue, there's the little number in the text, just in this case, it's in a novel, that then takes you down to the research that backs it, that shows, hey, this is not just dreamed up. This is actually from research. And sometimes it might be, a micro detail. Two characters are talking and a certain type of delivery drone flies overhead. In note to here's Amazon's patent for that delivery drone. Here's their plans for deploying it into Northern Virginia. Or it might be a macro issue. For example, algorithmic bias is a really important concept, fairly complex concept, though, An important, you know, it plays out everywhere from battlefield to police to family issues using and medical issues using AI. And so instead of trying to unpack that through a white paper, we reference the work on it, but then illustrate it through a scene where you follow a character, this FBI agent, and she's trying to find a terrorist in a crowd at a train station. So very quickly, you can visualize that. And then by the end of the scene, you walk away from it with an understanding of the basics of algorithmic bias. So the idea behind this combination is I joke, it's a little bit, I'm a parent, it's like sneaking fruit and veggies into a smoothie. So the reader gets the entertainment, it reaches a wider audience, but it carries through actually multiple years of research to back it. And so it's a in my mind, it's a new and we found actually more effective way of sharing needed information than the traditional white paper or PowerPoint brief or the like.
This is the first time that I've talked about a novel on this podcast. So I'm going to put this out here up front that I'm going to do my best to avoid spoilers.
That's, it's funny. That's one of the things that's great about it is, with nonfiction, we'd have no problem saying, what's your final conclusion? Give me the executive summary. With a novel, both of us, the creator, the reader, the sharer, we don't want to do that. And part of it also, it strangely kind of, we feel a responsibility because now we're part of this world, but it also, hopefully draws people in again, in a way, think about all the articles that, you and I have written where, we give the summary and then frankly, no one goes reads the article and we're only boiling down, the two sentence version of years of research. It's one of the fun things of this space as well.
I was going to ask you if your process was any different when you're doing the research for this type of project. It sounds like you're very passionate about the storytelling aspect, and that must have been really fun for you. Is there anything that stood out to you, or do you approach this similar to a project like your nonfiction work?
So it's there's definite similarities, and then there are clear differences. The similarity is that it follows the very same research, methodologies that we would with any nonfiction book. How those of us in the field are trained, and importantly, to use multiple methodologies. At least that's how I approach it. So you've got, gathering what we might think of, textual data, books, articles, reports, bringing them together sometimes in even, quantitative ways. So for example, one of the key issues that automation, AI is driving is changes in the workforce. And so we pulled together every single report that we could find on it, studies from professors at, Oxford University and MIT to organizations like the World Bank, OECD, to for-profit, consulting, McKinsey and PricewaterhouseCoopers. And, and they range in form from academic journal articles to, 70-page consulting reports to big spreadsheets. And we took all of the numbers that are in there of what they project and brought them all together into one place. So it's actually 1,300 of them in all. And it allows you to sort of see the distribution of these projections and how they play out in individual professions and the like. So you've got that going on, right? But then you're also doing interviews of everything from subject matter experts, AI scientists, CEOs of AI companies, not just from the US, but from China. But you're also interviewing, people in the field, so to speak. You're getting insights from, a character who is an FBI agent. What are they? One of the great things I found in my nonfiction, I think it carries through in the fiction, is interviews are really important too, because there's the things that people will publish and talk about. For example, in cybersecurity, threat reports. And then there's what they kind of talk about over beer. It's like, oh, you'll never believe this, but dot, 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 dot. So a funny version of that is I interviewed a water systems engineer for cities like Washington D.C., but he's also worked in several other major ones. And he is working at Plotspoil a little bit. He revealed major cybersecurity vulnerabilities in the sewer and stormwater systems that basically would allow through cyber means to cause a physical effect that would, in a situation, flood major parts of Washington, D.C. For listeners, you can Google 1936 Washington, D.C. flood to see the scale of what could be pulled off. And he's, you know, telling us this. It's not been published. And as we're talking, his wife is there, and she yells out, there's actually four valves. It's all you need to do to flip. She yells out, "You don't know him all that well. Don't tell him which four." So, you know, you have this research methodology going on, just like you would in any nonfiction book. But at the same time, you go back to that notion of the smoothie. You are trying to, also, it's got to have a good taste. It's got to be entertaining. It's got to carry people through the journey. So you're building characters, you're building scenes. But what I find is the commitment to the research helps with the fictional side, because this is, the more realistic it is, the more developed the characters, the more the scenes draw from the real world, I think it makes the fiction more compelling. And so it might be, you know, this broader thing of, hey, this actually is a cyber attack that could happen, that makes it all the more scarier. So it might be a little detail. So, you know, we follow the characters through Washington, D.C., everywhere from, okay, what's a Starbucks going to be like 10 years from now, to places that a lot of people haven't been to, but, you know, I can share with people, what's the carpet like in the White House Situation Room? And that little detail of the carpet builds that fiction scene, I think, all the more. So you're sort of serving two masters again.
Speaking of characters, tell us about Lara Keegan, our protagonist here, and her world as an FBI agent and her partner.
So the central character is another way that it's slightly different than the norm. It's strange, but it's just the way it's been. You can kind of hear the tone of my voice on that. In techno thrillers, there's a scarcity of female lead characters. If they are, they're usually the 1B, the helper to the male hero. And they tend to, going back to that notion of realism, be kind of one-dimensional characters. Frankly, there's a similar problem with the villain characters too. And in the real world, it's different. And so Keegan, it's a she, obviously enough, but she's a former Marine FBI agent, but she's also a mom of a five-year-old. She's also married and in a marriage that's not doing all that well. So it's a character with layers to it. And like all of us, juggling between all of these different identities and responsibilities. And in the story, she's been assigned a new technology for a burn-in. And a burn-in, here again, is a real-world term. It's the concept from engineering of when you deliberately push a new technology to the near breaking point in order to learn from it. And it's what's done with any new technology. And in this case, it's exploring how a certain type of AI is going to be utilized in the real world. And again, you know, we're going to plot spoil here. This is not the story of a robot revolt. We've had 100 years of that, exactly 100 years, going back to 1920 play. We've had 100 years of science fiction narrative about robot revolt. It's infiltrated our real world political science and policy discussions. There's scads of things written on killer robots and, you know, debate about it everywhere from the Pentagon to the United Nations to, by my tracking, we've seen Silicon Valley and foundations invest over $5 billion in research on the existential threat of robots. Well, guess what? In the real world, you know, maybe one day far off in the future, we're going to have to figure out whether to, you know, salute or fight our metal masters. But in the real world, and you're in my lifetime, the actual policy, economic, national security question we have to figure out with AI and robotics is this notion of how will it really be used? How will it be deployed? And all of the implications of it and kind of the burn-in effect of it. And so we follow Keegan and the system called TAMS, and TAMS is basically take, the Alexa, the Siri, the, decision aids deployed into everything from policing to military systems. And again, notice I'm giving real world references. I'm not, one of our rules is no vaporware. So it has to, you know, be drawn from there. Basically take that technology, take what's at prototype stage. What are its planned application by police? What are its planned applications in your home? Similarly, the hardware side, not dreaming up stuff, but for example, the many people have probably seen the YouTubes of like Boston Dynamics robotics doing parkour or whatnot. Basically, take the hardware side that's already the art of the possible and say, okay, what happens as you deploy this out there? And what through that story, what we surface are these key real world questions that we have to navigate with the use of AI and robotics and Internet of Things, you know, in kind of a similar way of, you know, Moby Dick is not a story about the hunt for a whale, right? You know, there's underlying things. The same thing here, there's a key, which you might on the fiction side call themes. But on the nonfiction side, say, these are the issues. These are the questions that we are going to have to find our answers to. And so, no, it's not robot revolt. It's what are the ripple effects of living through a new kind of industrial revolution? What are the questions that have to be worked out related to human-machine teaming? And what are the different forms? What are the proper and improper applications? What questions, again, moral, legal, political, economic, is brought out from it. Another core theme is, the tensions between, security, privacy, and, profit and convenience, which again is a dilemma that you see playing out in everything from, deployment of face recognition technology to the apps that your kids might use.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
A theme throughout the book is that TAMS, Agent Keegan's robotic partner, is always listening and learning, mm-hmm. which is a reminder that artificial intelligence is a product of what we teach it. Is that a message you think is sometimes lost in the discussion of AI?
Oh, yes. And in a couple of ways. The first is on the nonfiction side, there's a, you know, immense amount of literature on sort of a debate back and forth as to whether we will see more or less jobs. Particularly from, I'm going to pull back on it. There's this wonderful irony that as everything is being networked, we approach the problem set through field stovepipes. So the people that are interested in the future of work are different than the people who are interested in the future of war, are different than the people who are interested in legal, ethical, philosophic questions, are different than the people who are interested in Internet of Things, cybersecurity. And yet they, of course, all connect and cross. So, you know, one example of this, to answer your question, is you see a vast amount of debate about automation and its impact on jobs. And, you know, as I mentioned, we built this data set where, you know, at one end of the spectrum, you've got researchers at Oxford saying, you know, 47% of jobs will see automation. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have OECD saying, no, only 9%. 9% is still a pretty significant amount. But, you know, then you say, well, but we'll see all sorts of new professions like we saw out of the last industrial revolution. What that misses, one is when you look at it from other angles, is even if you're right and you see new profession surface, it's still an incredibly difficult transition period. And, you know, if you know the history of the last industrial revolution, you had both economic and, as a result, political winners and losers at everything from the individual level, the industry level, all the way up to the national level. It's part of the story of the rise of the United States as a great power. You saw its ripple effects onto politics in terms of new concepts and even ideologies. No industrial revolution, no workers' rights, women's rights, children's rights. Oh, by the way, industrial revolution also spawned fascism, communism. So, you know, the first is that idea of missing the complexity of it when you look at it from multiple different angles. The second, though, is that in the field, scientists describe how AI is a quote black box, and what they're going after is that the very value of it is that as a learning machine, and from observing us, it increasingly comes to conclusions, whether it's offering recommendations or taking actions, that we don't understand why or how. A version of this would be, you know, when new translation software comes out, they're like, here, this version is better. We don't know why or how it got to be that way. It's just better. And in the book, we sort of explain somewhat the process for how this plays out with neural nets. But the point is that, in that always learning, we don't know, kind of how or why it always plays out the way that it does. Now, that's a parallel a little bit to being a parent. There's things that you deliberately try and teach, and then there's what observed, and then it all kind of gets churned in there. And it's much the same increasingly with our AI. But oh, by the way, that's the very benefit for it. That's the very value. If we could do it, if we could understand ourselves, we wouldn't need the AI. So there's this sort of irony packed into that. But there's a second meaning to the black box that we try and, you know, use the format of the novel to go after, is that it's the importance of AI and yet the disconnect of understanding even the basics and these issues that we're talking about of its ripple effects. So I'll give you a numeric illustration, and then I'll give you an anecdotal. So, you know, kind of just like in grad school, I'd have different professors who would, you know, give a good grade for one or the other. The numeric one is a survey of leaders found that 91% of them said that AI is the most important game-changing technology out there. And that 91% is backed by, you know, if you do a scan of Fortune 500 strategy documents, again, the overwhelming majority talk about AI as the key to their future plans. So if you do a scan of national government documents, everything from the U.S. national defense strategy to China's 2030 plan. So you've got that kind of numeric scale. However, in a survey, only 17% of leaders self-reported that they even had a passing familiarity with AI, let alone the questions of its applications, the dilemmas, et cetera. And as you know, we all know, like when people self-report, that 17% is probably a high count, right? But even if they're all being honest, 17% versus 91%, that is a massive delta between. Now, the anecdotal version of how we're kind of getting this black box issue wrong is the Secretary of the Treasury a short while back said how AI and automation was not on the Trump administration's, quote, radar screen, end quote, because it was not going to be an issue for, quote, 50 to 100 years, end quote. That's verifiably false. It's not just that, you know, all these technologies will play out not over a period of 50 to 100 years, but to play out, you know, as we can document over the next 1 to 10 years, but it's already been an issue. For example, if you look at manufacturing job loss in the U.S. over the prior two decades, roughly about 85% of it was to automation. And so the point is that, you know, if you think of robotics and AI as some sci-fi far off in the distance issue, you are setting, whether it's your study of the future of war to your education programming for the future of work wrong.
TAMS has access to a ton of data, and he's able to pour through that instantly. And often the debate on data and data collection centers around privacy, but you see in the book that in many instances, and in real life as well, the horse is out of the barn because we readily give so much information freely, especially in the U.S. to corporations. Do you think the policy discussion on data and privacy needs to evolve to recognize these realities?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the most important thing is to understand not just the sheer scale of the data collected, but also what the addition of artificial intelligence into it allows. And you know, much like the broader issues within the book, all of this was at play before the coronavirus pandemic. You know, as I mentioned, there's a multi-year research.